Welcome to the SGO podcast on immunotherapy. Thank you so much for listening. As you all know, this is an evolving and exciting time in gynecologic oncology with the rise of immune checkpoint inhibitors in the treatment of gynecologic malignancies. Recently, dostarlimab was approved in the treatment of advanced primary or recurrent endometrial cancer in mismatch repair deficient or MSI-high tumors. There was also a recent SGO clinical practice statement published in Gynecologic Oncology last year addressing immunotherapy toxicities. This is part one of an ongoing series on immunotherapy toxicity. In today's session, we're going to be discussing the basics of immune-related adverse events. My name is Karen Shih, and I'm a gynecologic oncologist and assistant professor at Northwell Health Hofstra Medical School in Long Island, New York. I'm joined by two guests, Dr. Aaron Zaholsky and Dr. Sarah Hayward, who are both knowledgeable and experienced in the realm of immunotherapy. Welcome, ladies.
Welcome. Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much.
My name is Sarah Hayward. I am a clinical pharmacy specialist at the University of Oklahoma Health Science Center at Stephenson Cancer Center at OU Health. And I work specifically with our gynecology oncology team to help patients through the process that is chemotherapy and immunotherapy.
Like Dr. Hayward, I'm also a clinical oncology pharmacist in Richmond, Virginia. I'm an assistant professor at the VCU School of Pharmacy, where I have a clinical practice site in our gyn-onc clinic.
Thanks so much. So let's start by introducing the immune checkpoint inhibitors encountered in gynecologic oncology thus far. What is the mechanism of action of immune checkpoint inhibitors, and what are immune-related adverse events? Dr. Zaholsky?
As far as immune checkpoint inhibitors used to treat gyn malignancies, we're mostly working with PD-1 inhibitors like pembrolizumab, nivolumab, and dostarlimab. You may also see PD-L1 inhibitors like atezolizumab, and perhaps CTLA-4 inhibitors like ipilimumab and tremelimumab, depending on your practice and trial participation. These are monoclonal antibodies that inhibit immune checkpoints. PD-1, or programmed cell death protein 1, its ligand, PD-L1, programmed cell death ligand 1, and CTLA-4, or cytotoxic T cell antigen 4. PD-L1 is expressed on the surface of tumor cells, and it's able to bind to PD-1 on the surface of activated T cells and other immune cells. CTLA-4 is expressed on T cells, where it regulates early stages of T cell activation. The binding of immune checkpoints to their ligands leads to an immunosuppressive effect and allows the tumor to evade immune destruction. By inhibiting these checkpoints, T cells can become activated and the immune system can control the cancer. Of course, when reactivating these T cells, we run the risk of those T cells causing inflammatory damage to healthy tissues, as well as tumor cells. Hence, the recognition of a unique group of toxicities to immune checkpoint inhibitors called immune-related adverse events, and hence why we're here today.
Thank you. That's a really great summary, you know, and a very broad topic. So which immunotherapy toxicities are the most common, and how do these usually present?
To remember the most common immune-related adverse events, and I should mention that immune-related adverse events can affect pretty much any organ system, but to remember the ones that we are watching out for and the ones that have the highest risk of happening, I teach my pharmacy students the mnemonic LEGS, L-E-G-S, which I cannot take credit for. Its origin is urban legend, but L stands for liver, or hepatitis, or lungs, or pneumonitis. E is for endocrine, which most commonly refers to hypothyroidism. G is for GI or colitis. And then finally, S, skin or dermatitis. Another fun fact about this LEGS mnemonic is that if you reverse the order, it corresponds to the typical onset in which the adverse events occur, earliest to latest. So Sarah, let's you and I touch on some specifics about these five adverse events. What immune toxicity do you see most commonly in your clinic?
Sure, absolutely. And I'd like to comment. I love the acronym LEGS. I didn't know that. So I'm going to use that moving forward. Thank you so much. That's wonderful.
The students don't forget it. It's great.
That always helps. So, those are the exact five, not only when educating students or providers, but also with patient education points. And so What I'm going to talk about is just my approach to patient education when we're talking about these immune checkpoint inhibitors. So I tell patients really basically is like, this does not work like traditional chemotherapy. A lot of patients, when they encounter in the gynecologic oncology setting, when they encounter these PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitors, they've usually had some experience with traditional chemotherapy. So it's good. It gives them a comparison point that it's very different. I counsel them on time, very quick infusion, usually 30 to 60 minutes, no pre-meds. Rare chance of infusion reactions, but those can be easily mitigated with proper pre-meds and adjusting infusion times. But other than that, I tell patients the point of it is to ramp up your immune system. These medications do not directly affect the cancer cells, but actually use the body's immune system, all right? Augmenting the immune system to kill the cancer cells. And from a side effect standpoint, what can happen is the immune system gets out of hand. And this is where we have these autoimmune-like toxicities. Like Aaron mentioned earlier, it can affect any organ and tissue in the body. So always have a high level of suspicion. I always tell patients, when in doubt, give us a call. But the big five are skin toxicities, colitis, those endocrinopathies, specifically thyroid, that we're going to be monitoring their thyroid levels very closely. We talk about hepatotoxicity and how oftentimes it's not something that they usually notice. We catch on lab work, similar to the endocrinopathies, or specifically when we start seeing those thyroid dysfunctions. And then pneumonitis. So having a high suspicion for when they feel like they're getting a chest cold or have a new cough, especially accompanied by shortness of breath. And after that, I say, you need to let us know if anything strange or unusual happens. Like we said, it can affect any organ and tissue. So let's say if you start to have changes in your vision, or you start to have sudden onset weakness, or other things like that. It's important just to give us a heads up in case anything's going on. So that's my quick approach to patient education. Also making sure that, you know, in the setting of colitis, they're aware they can start taking some over-the-counter antidiarrheals, but they need to let us know that they are. That's always very important. The sooner we can approach and treat these side effects or unwanted adverse events, the sooner we can usually get them under control and have some better outcomes and continue therapy with the patient. Aaron, what's your approach when you have a patient in clinic to talk about these medications?
My approach is very similar. I like how direct you are in your approach. When I was learning immunotherapy, I learned all of these metaphors that people use, and you've probably heard some of these in the past. I had a co-resident who discussed this elaborate duck-duck-goose process, and I think there are good ways to use metaphors to explain immunotherapy to patients. But as I was looking into this, I found a small study out of Emory that actually showed that using metaphors for immunotherapy toxicity are only understood about half of the time. So I tend to take a very direct approach. This is what the immune system is doing, and this is why toxicity happens. Something that I also really support doing, and I do this, you know, hand in hand with my providers in clinic, is these immune-related adverse events happen commonly enough that we do need to communicate the risk, especially now that we're seeing immunotherapy move into adjuvant roles. So it's possible that patients could be cured of their cancer and have lasting immune toxicities. So really just communicating how frequently these happen, how they can happen anytime, and how they can potentially need, you know, inpatient treatment, long courses of steroids, and that could have an impact on their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's definitely an important point to bring up, especially that we can see these toxicities up to a year after they've ever gotten their last dose of pembrolizumab or whichever it may be, to always maintain that high level of suspicion for a while as a provider and as a patient, for that matter. It's very important.
Up to a year after? Wow, that's... What is the mechanism for that?
Immune system's weird. Why do some of us get bad COVID and some of us don't? I don't know.
A lot of question marks.
I mean, so true. And there are studies coming out about even after patients stop immune therapy, they can have a lasting tumor effect. So I think it's theorized that it's for the same reason. You have this upregulation of the immune system, and that can exert both good effects and also toxicicities.
Just tells us still a lot to learn about this therapy as it's, you know, up and coming in our field. Do you guys have tips for expedient workup of these adverse events?
Sure. I think one of the best things you can do is just make sure that the providers and clinic as a whole have a mechanism in place for proper monitoring of lab work, proper follow-up with patients to make sure that they're doing well. However often you want to see the patient in clinic to make sure that they're doing well. And then again, that sort of high level of suspicion. When you start to see your LFTs, for example, creep up, that means you probably want to do labs a little bit more often just to see which direction they're trending in. And then as far as when do you need to involve a consult service, you know, for the setting of pneumonitis, you're probably going to consult pulmonology a little bit sooner than say if you have some skin toxicities that you can usually control with some topical steroids, depending on the extent of it, versus getting in someone to see dermatology. And it's really just following guidelines, having a good knowledge base for how the medication works and what you need to be looking for and how often you need to be doing lab workup, and continuing to look at those guidelines because they change often. And this be able to use your support services, right? We don't all know everything, but we should all at least know where to look or who to ask. So that's an important thing in treating these patients.
Can you guys describe the basic treatment course for patients with high-grade toxicities?
Absolutely. So as Sarah mentioned, treatment hopefully starts with early recognition, where we can detect and prevent high-grade toxicity from happening. However, for most grade 3 and 4 toxicities, we're going to hold immunotherapy and administer oral or IV steroids dosed anywhere from 1 to 2 milligrams per kilogram per day, depending on the toxicity, as first-line therapy. This would be considered high-dose steroids used to cause, you know, T-cell apoptosis, suppress inflammation, and cease that tissue destruction that's happening. Of course, there are some high-grade toxicities that don't warrant steroids, so I'll talk about those briefly. Some examples of those are hypothyroidism. This is one of the few toxicities where we may be able to treat with levothyroxine, thyroid replacement, and continue the immune checkpoint inhibitor unless the patient's experiencing life-threatening symptoms. This may be self-explanatory, but it is possible for the patients to develop immune checkpoint-induced or worsened diabetes. So this is an example where we are not going to use high-dose steroids, but immunotherapy will be held and insulin would be used. So back to steroids, the average patient is going to be receiving 60 to 120 milligrams of prednisone daily. Hospitalized patients may require IV methylprednisolone. And remember that when you're transitioning that back to oral, you have to do some steroid conversions for potency. So remember your conversions or talk to your pharmacist. But after this initial dosing, patients are expected to respond with improvement in symptoms within 72 hours. If this is not the case, the toxicity is considered to be steroid refractory, and an adjunct immunosuppressive agent like infliximab or vedolizumab or others can be used depending on the toxicity. As Sarah was saying, consulting a subspecialist is so important for these toxicities, and that is especially the case when considering these adjunct agents. We'll talk about this and other more nuanced immune checkpoint inhibitor situations on a later podcast. So best case, the patient's symptoms resolve to grade 1. And at that point, we can taper the steroids over 4 to 6 weeks. This is not a situation where a quick taper is possible. Long tapers are needed to prevent recurrence of toxicity, which can and does happen. So because I'm mentioning these high-dose steroids, it is very possible that patients will have side effects from these steroids. So I'll hand it over to Sarah to talk a little bit about some supportive care opportunities this brings.
Thanks, Erin. And then I just wanted to go back and make sure that people understand that when we talk about milligrams per kilogram per day, that's an actual body weight. So not ideal or anything like that, but actual body weight. So it can be a lot of steroids, and it's important to counsel patients appropriately on that. You can do this as a once daily dose. Sometimes patients like to divide it up, just being careful to try and take it away from bedtime because these oral corticosteroids and IV for that matter can cause patients to have some insomnia, which can definitely affect their well-being considering they're going to be on these for a pretty extended course of time. So other things to consider with supportive care management on patients on high-dose steroids is considering GI prophylaxis with a proton pump inhibitor of your choice. Doesn't have to be particularly high dosing, but to do this for your patient just to help protect their stomach, especially when they're going to be on greater than 20 milligrams per day for an extended period. The more important one that we like to make sure we cover is PJP prophylaxis, which is pneumocystis pneumonia prophylaxis. And this is also something that you want to do for your patients when they are on 20 milligrams or greater per day of a prednisone equivalent. So that's prednisone or equivalent dosing. For more than 4 weeks, which can be the case depending on how long our taper is going to last and when the patient responds to the initial high-dose steroid. This can be accomplished with trimethoprim sulfa or Bactrim, as it's more commonly known. For those patients that have sulfa allergies, you also have the option of Dapsone or Etovaquone are things to consider. For other things, just, and we don't usually, my clinic doesn't necessarily get into these, but there's also fungal prophylaxis, but this is really for long, extended, greater than 6 weeks of greater than 20 milligrams per day. And then also long-term use of steroids can affect bone health. So considering vitamin D and calcium supplementation to help reduce the risk of osteopenia and osteoporosis is important for these patients.
While we're talking about some of the more practical things that happen with steroids, I'm wondering, Sarah, if you have any strategy for what strength of prednisone you usually send. Do you have a favorite way to do this?
Yes, this is my favorite way when we know we're going to have to start a patient on high-dose steroids, is determine what is our dose going to be. Anywhere, sometimes for some of our milder ones, we can do 0.5 milligrams per kilogram per day, obviously up to 2. Is round that to the nearest whole number of tablets with as few number of tablets as I can offer them. I only like to send about a week or two of the high dose first, determine if it is working for the patient after reevaluating that 3 to 5 to 7 days, depending on the toxicity. If we start to see resolution, and especially once we get resolution to a grade 1, and we can work on that extended 4 to 6 week taper, then that's where this is a great point to use your clinical pharmacist or pharmacist if you have one available. I try to use the one dose of prednisone that I can, so whether that's 10s or 20s, and then decrease at what is going to be easy for the patient to understand, providing a calendar for them. So this could be, you know, every 3 to 5 days dropping by 10 milligrams or 20 milligrams. All the way until you get down to 5 or 10, at which point you can stop the patient. Do know that at a point of 10 milligrams of prednisone, we are able to restart, if it's appropriate, an immune checkpoint inhibitor, depending on the situation and the toxicity. That's our cutoff, but that's my approach. Provide a calendar, send it in parts, depending on how their toxicity is resolving, and as few strengths of prednisone as possible to prevent confusion. How about you, Erin?
All of that was honestly music to my ears. I take a very similar approach. I do really like how you only send a short amount of that high-dose steroid, because that facilitates assessment and makes sure that they're not on these high doses long after they've had a response. I think that that's a great approach. I do a similar thing for our patients when they're tapering. I usually can send the 10 milligram tablets and have them take, you know, twice a day or once a day, variations of those 10 milligrams until they're down to 10 milligrams once a day or off. I will say one thing that I didn't hear you mention, and this might just be my personal technique, is for doses of over 50 milligrams, I will usually split those to twice a day just for GI tolerability. I don't know if you do anything similar.
We have on occasion, it's sort of on a patient by patient basis, but no, for those patients who don't tolerate such a large dose once a day, absolutely. And usually when I do have a patient do a split dose of a high dose steroid, I will have them do an AM dose and an afternoon dose instead of an AM and a bedtime dose, just to help alleviate taking it away from bedtime.
Love it. And I'll always say take with food too. That tends to help with a stomach upset.
Certainly does.
Can you guys share some resources that you find useful for evaluating and treating immune-related adverse events?
Absolutely. So I can start on this one. My usual first go-to are the ASCO guidelines. They came out, I think, in somewhere around 2018, but were updated in 2021. The thing that I like about the ASCO guidelines is that they have very descriptive yet concise tables for each immunotherapy toxicity. I like to be able to find everything in one place. I also find these guidelines helpful because they're is discussion of controversies, gaps in research, and then even future directions, which is nice to have a starting place to look into for those situations.
Yeah, I agree. That's a great resource. You can also find algorithms in NCCN guidelines as well about where you should start. And then depending on the grade of the toxicity, what would be the most appropriate path to go down. And then obviously you're going to find a lot of good publications out there for or case studies for some little known approaches. And I think that would be something we'll address in the second part of this discussion.
Definitely. I like NCCN too. I think it's, you know, it could be helpful for us in the future that that guideline, the management of immunotherapy related toxicities by NCCN, also has CAR-T and BiTE therapy toxicity management. So who knows, maybe that will become relevant to have all of these immunotherapy toxicities in one guideline. I must say I have a new favorite. As Dr. Shi talked about in the introduction of this podcast, SGO released a clinical practice statement by Dr. O'Carroll and colleagues. And this practice statement, if you haven't looked at it yet, it's specific to gyn-onc patients. It addresses some common overlapping toxicities that we see with medications like lenvatinib and immunotherapy. It's concise, it's informative. I think it's an awesome tool for trainees and providers who would like a useful refresher and go-to resource. So I highly recommend that one too.
Wow, guys, that was really a wealth of information that we went over today, basically immune-related adverse events in a big nutshell. So I just want to thank you both so much, Dr. Zaholsky and Dr. Hayward, for sharing your insights on this topic. Thank you all for listening today. Stay tuned for part two of our series, which will be addressing common controversies in immune checkpoint inhibitors.
Thank you so much, Dr. Shi. It was a pleasure to be here.
Yes, thank you so much. It's great to be a part of this team.
The information presented is that of the contributing faculty and presenters and does not necessarily represent the views of the Society of Gynecologic Oncology or any named company or organization providing financial support. Specific therapies discussed may not be approved and/or specified for use as indicated by the faculty or presenters. If you like what you heard today, please let us know by leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and hitting the follow button wherever you're listening. If you have suggestions for future SGO On The Go podcasts, please email us directly at education@sgo.org.